Hello and welcome to episode 7 of Rethinking Work. On this week's podcast, we have a megastar in our eyes, Fred Mills from the B1M, which is one of the biggest YouTube channels that I watch, and he's grown it from 5,000 subscribers when I first saw him about 5 or 6 years ago to almost getting up to 2.5 million. He's had an enormous effect on the industry, and we wanted to talk to him because we're architects, Able Partners create amazing buildings, and we wanted to talk to him because he's made the construction industry seem cool and sexy again. He's had Richard Branson on, he's had Thomas Heatherwick, he's had Bjark Ingels, all people we would love to interview. And he's done it all already and done some really impactful videos. And where did we interview him?
We went to his place in Victoria, and he was just so humble and encouraging and a bit of a rock star. And he's absolutely killing it. And it was a big inspiration to us. And I thought it was brilliant.
He's just such a nice guy as well. He's always very generous with his time and very supportive of us and me doing podcasts. And he was great to have on. So enjoy the episode. Oh, get in touch with us on Instagram at @Able_partners or on Twitter, @Able_partners. Thank you. I haven't shaved, and they're like, I know, get rid of that right away. Right, well, I'm going to pretend that that was a seamless introduction, but I realize that every time I talk to you, something big happens in my life, Fred.
Are we recording now?
Yeah, we're recording now. Excellent. Yeah, this is your official introduction. I first spoke to you, 6 years ago? And you had a little YouTube channel about construction, which I don't think anyone was particularly thought would be the sexiest industry. It had 5,000 subscribers, and I was like, whoa, he's got 5,000 subscribers. This is mental. Fast forward 6-7 years, you've now got pretty much 2.3 million. Yeah. The numbers aren't important to you, I know, and it's 2.31011. It's grown massively. And then it was my birthday last year, and you let me interview you for Create More a second time. And then I asked you to interview you this year. And then obviously COVID and a few other things happened. And now you're here on our wonderful new podcast, Rethinking Work. So how's things going, Fred?
Yeah, well, I'm back on your podcast again, Ben, like a COVID variant, just keep coming back, just can't get rid of me.
And now you know you've made it, because now you're on with third time, my third repeat guest. But like,
barrel scraping, are you now?
No, God.
Just email Fred again, just get him on, go on.
Fred will be the third guest.
I love how you introduce yourself as Ben and Bill, not Bill and Ben.
Well, we
can't avoid that, are you? Bill and Ben the flower boy.
Annoyingly, when we haven't wanted
Bill and Ben
to joke,
architecture
joke about it, people have gone, oh, like Bill and Ben. And then we've tried to use it to someone younger, they've gone, okay.
Yeah, actually, Fred, you're aging yourself there, because that's a reference that most our digital native listeners wouldn't fully appreciate.
If you're under 30, please keep listening.
Yeah.
Please stay with us.
Exactly. Well, so you've had COVID to deal with, you've had a million and one things to deal with, but I did think that if you could just give us, I want to know, like, because you started so long ago, how long ago did you actually start?
So officially started the YouTube channel alongside my day job 2012, so it's been 10 years this year.
2012, because you know we're a startup. You know we're creating a business, and kind of the founder story and the kind of the startup story has been so interesting to get to talk to. All the other guests we've had on have all been founders or CEOs, and they've had the most interesting stories. And I think there's it's really satisfying and interesting to hear that it's not this overnight success. I mean, yes, you're massive now, but my God, you put a lot of work into it. So how did it start, and when did you quit your job? And
yeah, so started it 2012, as I said, so kind of created the YouTube channel, incorporated the company 2012 alongside my day job. So I was doing videos and edits myself in the evening around work. They are absolutely terrible. Please don't go and watch them. They are still on the internet.
Are they still on there?
The worst ones have been hidden now. But
because I love going back to look at the first ones.
Don't do that.
Yeah. It's good. Satisfying.
Don't do that. He says, rushing off after this podcast to go and delete YouTube before people find it. Yeah, so alongside my day job, I kind of got enough traction behind it to go full time. Well, I went part time for my job in 2014 and then full time in 2015. And I was always kind of pushing for that. I always wanted it to be a full time thing for me, but getting to the point where I could, actually, with a mortgage and kids, actually make that leap, quit your professional job and go start a YouTube channel, which is pretty freaking terrifying.
It should be noted, when YouTube was not a big obvious thing that you could quit your job and go and do, right? It wasn't massive then.
Yeah, telling your parents you're going to be a YouTube star is one of those red flags, isn't it?
Yeah, I had the whole, people were like, oh, that's fantastic. Yeah, and what are you doing for work? I was like, well, no, this is my work.
Oh, how wonderful. You're doing videos.
Yeah, and I, yeah, it's that's that was a bit of a journey because I had a lot of people around me who I respected, who I'd built respect with in my professional proper career, who were like, you know, what are you doing? This isn't worth it. Maybe it's time to throw the towel in and get a real job. That was extremely lonely. And there were, like, you know, probably my wife and my parents were the only people that believed in it in that moment. And even they had days where they were like, you know, I could tell they were going along with it for me. So, yeah, and it's kind of, you have to go through that valley, I think, to appreciate where it goes to in the end and to value and care for what you've built.
Did you have quite a clear vision? I remember, because I was talking quite early on, you seemed to have quite a clear vision of what you wanted. Did you, you know, day one, you're like, I'm going to do this, then you went part-time and you went full-time. Did it deviate from your plan, or did you really just like doggedly stick to it and that's how you got massive?
Yeah, I think there wasn't like a calendar with key dates written down that I planned out in advance or anything like that. I think the objective's always been the same. I wanted my own successful, impactful company that changes how people think about architecture and construction on this planet. Now, the tactics and the route I had to take and the opportunities that opened, the doors that closed, changed as you go through. Of course they do. You have to adapt and, you know, go with the flow and take the situation as it comes to you, like we all do in life. But the overall goal, objective, hasn't shifted. I think having that North Star's made it easier to kind of triangulate and frame everything in terms of where you're going. If you know what you want to achieve, being able then to apply the question, well, does X, Y, or Z decision help me get to where I want to be or not, helps you then frame things.
So that North Star as a long-time listener, first-time interviewer of the great Fred Mills, for me, that North Star, well, what I see is optimism and faith in the construction industry. I see lots of well-researched, factual, well-delivered, clear, crisp information. But is the North Star more around numbers? I want this many viewers. I want to reach this many people. Was it about the audience, or was it about the message more?
I think the message, and obviously it's a hard thing to measure. I'm talking about trying to fundamentally change how people see architecture and construction on this planet. How you measure that is next to impossible. Obviously there are lots of metrics that help us do that around view count, subscribers and stuff. But I think if you just go out and try and target numbers, you're not really going to get anywhere. You need to have that deeper, more passionate, more emotive vision behind what you do. I think one thing, to come back to what Ben was saying a minute ago, I think it's very easy to look back now at my journey and go, oh, this was genius. The guy did this, then he did this, and it was all very well planned out. And it wasn't like that. I've made it up as I've gone along, like we all have in life. And I think it's easy to look at successful people and go, oh, that's the model. That's what you should do. But actually, I said this to you last time, Ben. I try and be as honest and candid as possible because it's not plain sailing, and it has taken me 10 years to become an overnight success. And people will, it's very easy to look at me or other people now online and think, wow, aren't they great? Aren't they successful? It's not the full picture. It's a part of the picture, and you need to understand that.
What I thought was interesting, I was like, oh, I wonder how many, today when we're doing a bit of research, I wonder how many competitors you have. And I started looking, and immediately some other like competitors, won't mention the names, come up. But what was interesting is they didn't have their own faces. They didn't have a personality. They had a unique voice, as in like a voice that tracked through. But I felt like maybe, you know, you saying you were working out as you went along was like you were the key person in it. And I'm sure that's been a benefit and a negative as you've gone along. The pressure on you to be each week, turn up, do the videos, be in them has been, I'd imagine, stressful. But then the flip side is that you are so core to it that I think people engage more with the person, and they can look you in the eyes and see what you look like, go on your Instagram feed.
100%. It's a blessing and a curse. Exactly what you've described. It's an asset and a limitation. It's a benefit and a drawback.
Yeah.
I can't really have a day off, which is pretty frustrating. But then people connect and resonate with it more because it's got that personality behind it. I almost refer to that as a in the third person. I know it's me, but it's almost a third person because it is not the full me, if you know what I mean. It's the me that people see online, but there's the other Fred Mills with, you know, kids and...
Yeah, and I mean, Henry DeSuna is a former guest, and he makes a good point about you've got to be the YouTube guy, you've got to be the office guy, you've got to be a sort of rather singular version of yourself, because public perceptions aren't patient or broad, you know, and so you become that guy and you've got that face. It struck me as that it's this sort of perfect, well, not perfect, but a happy coincidence of the rise of YouTube as a big platform with the globalization of design and construction and that very outward looking period before Brexit and all these changes. But actually it was the right platform, really interesting content. And it struck me that it is very transnational, you know, not just the where the projects are, but the messages and the really clear type font and the facts that relate to everyone. It doesn't feel very local. It feels like it has very broad appeal.
Yeah, that's always been the idea, I think, is to make it as accessible as possible to people. I've lamented for a long time the fact that the construction, engineering and architecture sectors do amazing work, but my goodness me, do we make it boring when we talk about it. You know, I watched a guy, he was giving a presentation about the Grand Paris Express once, and it was 45 minutes long, and there was one photo in the entire thing. It was just slide after slide after slide of bullet point. I'm like, you're digging an enormous tunnel under the center of one of the world's biggest, most historic cities. For goodness sake, make it interesting, man. What are you doing?
You know that bit in The Office where he's like, can you explain it to me like I'm an 8-year-old? It's like, but the wonderful thing
about... And then he says, can you explain it again like I'm a 5-year-old?
Make it even simpler. But what's really good is, because you're saying, no, this is a 6 to 8, 10 minute video max, I can't go into too much detail, which means you get the really interesting, fun stuff, because contractors and people who design the buildings would be so desperate to tell you way too much information, and you get to like kind of say, great, but we'll take the
You do get that sense of some of the interviews when you're interviewing like a project manager on some of the sites, that they want to tell you about this, not the mass damper that's hanging in the air. They want to tell you about this retaining structure, and you move something. I wonder if it is that art construction has an image problem, or had an image problem before your impact, or is misunderstood. I think its relationship with carbon is quite complicated, and there's a lot of excuses to bash it. And we think architecture has a bit of an image problem as well, and certainly new construction has a lot of negativity around it. And I just think it's brilliant to have someone who's championing it and explaining some of the complexities behind it. I did wonder if deconstruction and urban mining and all of these things that are pretty exciting as well, whether that was the next conversation for construction and you guys, or whether growth is more exciting.
It's a good, I mean, the whole debate about the future of the built environment more generally, I think, is really interesting at the moment. You know, do we need all this office space? Do we need the real estate we used to have in the locations we historically had it in? All of that is up for grabs. I think we've done a bit of stuff on our sister channel, Tomorrow's Build, around deconstruction, materials, recycling, all that kind of stuff, you know, how we sustain ourselves on this planet as a society is a really interesting area. So yeah, I think we want to kind of keep the B1M as the core. You know, we've got big ambitions to make that deeper, more engaging, more entertaining, but I think sticking to the kind of the core of what that is successful for is what we want to do. I think if we're going to go into other areas, it's going to be in other publishing channels probably. So
and do you, how much of the topics that you choose are kind of your things that you're passionate about, or things did you go, well, you know, I'd love to know more about timber construction, can we do more about that? Or how much of you and your passions do you kind of focus the channel on?
You've got to be passionate if you're going to do it. If you're going to spend the time creating it, going there and filming, voiceovering, any of that, you have to be passionate about it. I think people can tell pretty quickly if you don't believe in something. So
yeah, definitely. I mean, do you watch the Colin and Samir show? They basically critique.
Killed your question, isn't it?
No. A little bit. But they critique creators on YouTube, and it was fascinating. Jesus. That they were. It's really, really interesting. But
that sounds horrifying.
Yeah, but
it was, they're here today, just with a couple of bits of feedback.
Mind you should get on the show. It's great. But anyway, the point is,
I've been roasted on YouTube by somebody else once.
Have you?
Yeah, he took pictures from my Instagram. It was like, this guy just benches steel beams. Look at him. So he just gets overexcited about anything. Bastard.
You're like, it doesn't bother me. You go home.
It doesn't bother me. It doesn't bother me, Ben. I can't stop talking about it.
Oh, that's a nice way of getting roasted. God knows what.
That's not too bad, is it?
It could have been a lot worse. Because it was all over Twitter that I'd been roasted. And I was like, oh, God, I'm going to click play on this video, braced for hell. And it was fine. The other people got it a lot worse than me.
So. You're like, you're just calling me enthusiastic and I'm strong. I mean, I'll take that all day long.
Thanks, mate.
do the comments and stuff bug you? Do you go in the comments? I mean, I look through and they're kind of, they seem really genuinely quite nice.
Well, I didn't mean to interrupt there, but yeah, I read them and I wanted to just add to that. They generally are commenting about the content, what a Hyperloop will mean or why it's discredited or why it's a really great idea, rather than Fred seems to have put on a few pounds over the summer or something. And I think that is a sort of complete compliment to the channel, right?
Yeah, people should be talking about the content, not the fact there's a glitch in the edit here or something's wrong or it's not put together very well or there's a factual error, God forbid. The comments, the majority of them are positive. There are negative ones. There are conspiracy theorists. You know, it's the internet. You know, people are going to be who they are. If there's a video of me wearing a mask, that seems to lock into the underbelly of the world about the whole mask debate and that all comes up. So, yeah, but on the whole, we've got good positive comments. So.
And that YouTube community seems quite exciting to me. Has that been a force for good, or is it not something you engage with and you're on your own?
I think for us, it's been a force for good. I think there are, YouTube is pretty strong reflection of society in a way, in that there's all types of people doing all types of things. And there's all types of stuff you can find. The audience we've built and cultivated and who remained loyal to us are, for the most part, pretty sane, pretty normal, care about building construction, genuinely have an interest in the world. They're very progressive in their outlook, and they care about our subject areas. Other people who run channels about Bitcoin or conspiracy theorists or politics or Trump.
I like to use to put politicians in that bracket.
Well, but it's more polarizing and divisive, and you do get into different parts of the internet. And yeah, thankfully that's not something I'm really keen on getting into.
Well, I think because going back to the idea of the globalization of construction things, the reason I brought up that Colin Samir thing was Mr. Beast being a classic case of one of the biggest YouTubers. They are now overdubbing in Spanish and Indian and Chinese and then reissuing their videos and getting more views and stuff in different countries with different. So someone would dub over your voice. If they get famous celebrities, people who are quite famous in that region, to dub over his videos. Mm-hmm. And then they repost them. So it's just the B1M Espanol, the B1M Chinese. And it's like,
is Gloria Estefan doing Fred Mills in Spain?
Could well be.
In Spain. It's a great idea.
It's like, because it's so digestible information that it just with an overdub. And then I'm just thinking of your figures, Fred. And then if you want to give me a
Well, and also it might solve your problem about having to be the figurehead and there at every edit. Suddenly you've got a Spanish James Corden doing a kind of...
This is genius.
But do you I've noticed that some of your videos you've tried to ask not controversial questions, but there's kind of public opinion of certain topics that you feel I'm referring to one with Thomas Heatherwick. I can't remember the question, but essentially it was about do you think architects should be building new buildings? But you have to very softly ask a slightly controversial question. Is that you don't really push them too far? Is that a purposeful decision that you don't try and take a strong view on things or trying to be, does that make sense?
I don't know. I think we have taken some pretty strong views on some things in some videos. We don't do it all the time. We don't court controversy, but I think where it's due, we do bring it up. The Qatar Stadium video, I think, is a good example. I think Little Island is a good example. Yes, I was talking to Thomas Heatherwick directly, but you can't get away from the fact that that is a controversial project. And he had questions to answer about that controversy and that use of money. Same thing with Branson on Hyperloop. There are a lot of people out there who doubt him. So what does he think of that? And I think that there's a way to ask those questions in a polite professional setting without grilling someone or demolishing them or catching them out that is not really our game.
Are they kind of not up for it's the wrong phase, but I guess I know from organizing a small scale podcast that you have to try and build relationships with the people you're trying to get on before they'll ever agree to come on. And then they come on and then you've got to go, look, I do have to ask this question. Or do they?
I guess, to use it as a platform to address concerns that they know are in the public domain, and that's why they're coming, I would have thought.
I think there's a mutual respect we've built now where they understand that what makes our content successful and the benefit of them being on our platform is the editorial integrity that comes with that. And actually, us, you know, if we just did puff pieces all the time, people aren't going to want to be part of that because, oh yeah, another puff piece, another positive one on them. Whereas actually, if they know it's proper, fair, it's got good editorial integrity behind it, yeah, they fully understand and respect our right to ask those questions. And I think, you know, a lot of the people in these positions, it might feel scary to ask them the questions, but they've been asked them before, and they, you know, as by virtue of holding the positions they do, are obligated, in my opinion, to answer tough questions.
I'm thinking
about
the viewing figures if Branson was to flounce off after a difficult question halfway through.
And you know, like the guitar one, I mean, that's like, do you get a lot of kickback on, do people in the comments or I don't know, like emails from developers or something?
Not especially, no. We've done some projects where we have not covered them because the developers said, yeah, we're only gonna take part in this if you cover it positively. And we're like, well, no, you're not gonna do that. You know, we have to stand by our editorial values and our judgment. And
so you've turned down some big topics because
many a time.
Oh,
there's
really?
Lots of videos we could have done that we haven't done. So
we're gonna need names, Fred.
Yeah,
we're gonna need to.
There was Bill and Ben the flower boy.
Outrageous. I think I'll move this one. So we are. This is about rethinking work. And so we're trying to build back to your own business, which was you.
Nice pivot, by the way.
I know. Hey, nice, I've done a few.
Nice pivot.
Rather crass.
Just take a moment to admire that.
It's become a running joke. It's the crowbar, the Ville crowbar.
I've got my list here.
I enjoyed it.
But, you know, you were a guy, I assume, you know, in his apartment, outside work, starting this, and you are now a team of 14?
15 people, including me.
15. And tell us about that. We're in here in your amazing offices, and you were just saying before we started that they might not be your offices forever.
I think we're definitely going to have an office here and an address here, but I think post-COVID, you know, we tend to work remotely now. So paying for desk space for everybody in central London is probably not something we're going to be doing long-term. Having a more flexible model and, you know, using that rent, a chunk of that rent money, putting it into other parts of the company is part of the goal, yeah.
And is that because it's a very digital product and some of the outputs are very measurable and can be done independently? Or is it just that is the trend that you're seeing across the whole industry?
The fact that we're digital is an enabler, definitely. But I think any business is made successful by its people. And I think that hasn't changed from hundreds of years ago through, you know, the industrial revolution, all those kind of things. I think people think it might have changed. I think people think the internet has changed things, but fundamentally, yeah, it's changed markets, it's changed business models, but fundamentally what makes companies successful, in my opinion, is its people. And we found that, you know, what most people tend to look for, what most of the best talent want these days is flexible remote working. And that's something that's cheap, free, basically free for us to offer.
And do you prefer that shift? As in, I guess you've been forced to work remotely, therefore you've got over the hump and you've put systems in place. But in an ideal world, do you like everyone in one big room, or is it fine?
There's pros and cons. I think building a culture, onboarding people, having a real open debate is harder online. That's why we do some of our editorial meetings and some of our team meetings on a regular basis in person, which is really important. But I think the culture of you shall be in the office Monday to Friday 9 to 5 is over, and I wouldn't really want to be doing that myself. You know, I equally enjoy the remote working basis of stuff. It gives us benefits in some ways. It gives us opportunities. It gives us challenges in others. So it's kind of a bit swings and roundabouts. What I'm probably describing is what pretty much everyone listening to this podcast would have been through in the last 2 years. You know, it's there are pros and cons basically.
Yeah, I can tell. I mean, especially if you've got kids. I mean, Bill doesn't know, but you actually named your eldest after me, didn't you? I remember that. Yeah.
Third time you've made that joke. Third podcast.
This is for new listeners, though, so I feel like I'm in the safe space.
Sorry. Definitely don't go back to 2020 or 2016 and find that joke again, guys.
I'm absolute burn by the biggest. You've made my day, Fred. That is the best thing that's ever happened.
Remember, I have editorial control over this. We'll just hear my joke and then us laughing, and it'll be a perfect joke.
I did name my son after you, Ben, because of his repetitive jokes, basically.
I've been rehearsing that all day. Remember to say it like with this inclination here and slip it in for Bill's benefit. I think it worked perfectly.
I'm so sorry.
I think it's time for one of my pivot. Really pivot uncomfortable pivots.
Pivot now.
I'm quite interested about this idea of the B1M, which seems a rather sort of not the smoothest name, but it's now, as a result, being very like...
You're very generous with that,
Bill. No, but it's very identifiable. And now it's Tomorrow's Build is more kind of congruent with the other things you see online. And why you have sort of split this brand out a little bit, is it to help growth? Is it to give some bits of autonomy away to your team so that they have some sort of editorial control that doesn't just come back to you? Is it about revenue streams? Or what's that sort of fragmentation about?
I think for us, we wanted to, the B1M was very broad before we did the Tomorrow's Build split out. And there was lots of stuff in there from, hey, look at this dam, to billionaire skyscrapers, to climate change, to, what's the shape of our cities, to new materials. And we just wanted to basically create a more focused audience. I think there's a real urgency now to how we build the future on this planet. And I think pulling that out and giving it its own stream, not just a series, but its own clear channel. We create that, I was going to say physical, but that digital, that clear kind of almost manifesto on how to build better in the future, that guidebook on how to build the future for people, I think is really powerful. I think we did that with B1M. We created a platform that was the go-to for understanding and falling in love with the construction industry. Doing that in a channel about how we build the future, let's build our world like this, let's build our world like this is the strapline, which I think was a really important thing to do it from a mission perspective, because I really do care about building a better world for my kids and their kids. And I think that's kind of a part of our obligation, really, was to do that. There were other benefits as well. It gives us a more focused audience. So as a media publisher, we've got two more focused audiences now, which is more attractive from a revenue perspective. It enables us to expand. We've got ambitions to launch further channels as well. So proving we can launch one successfully was a good thing. So there was other like business benefits to it, but they weren't the drivers.
And that thing about driving change is the ultimate point. I mean, we do this podcast, for lots of reasons, partly we get to meet lots of great people, but a lot of it is ultimately, can we change how people think about work, or can we overcome some of the prejudices about working from home or virtually or hybrid, or what's wrong with the office and how do we address them? What do you think you've been able to change? I know I've kind of just dumped that on you with no warning, but for example, cities are becoming greener and they're becoming better. They're becoming much better cities to cycle in. I'm particularly thinking about London, but Paris and lots that I can think of. I wonder if you feel there was something that you've really helped that conversation evolve.
It's a good question. It's one I ask myself on a regular basis. And I know we're all our own worst critics. I'm probably too harsh on myself most of the times, but
you're quite harsh on Ben as well.
One thing we've noted
after you named your son after me.
One thing we've noted. Fred Mills is harsh on Ben in his book. I'm so sorry.
Good guy, Fred Mills.
Yeah. I'm so sorry.
So mean.
Yeah, I mean, I ask myself that a lot. We've got tens of thousands of people that have commented, and hundreds of people that have spoken to us or messaged us and emailed us, telling us the impact that we've had on their lives. I never forget the people we met in. When we go and do physical meetups, we've done one now in Washington D.C., L.A., New York. Meeting people on the ground there is incredible, because I had one guy say to me, I can't thank you enough because my family now understand what I do for a living. I feel prouder of my job because of your videos. And that was like an incredible feeling. I think there's no doubt more people in the world now that feel construction is better understood because of what we've done. I want to go a lot further than that. I don't think we've had enough impact. I'm frustrated at the impact we've had. I want to go far beyond it just being a YouTube channel. So we've got big plans for Overtake, and I'm constantly kind of self-criticizing.
You say that because I did like a little count, and I was looking at like one, your competitors, but like if you look in the IR industry, like I added in like BD, like Design, all these other kind of architectural channels, their YouTube count. I was like, I wonder how big they are in America. There's Architectural Digest. I mean, you add them all up and you're still bigger than every other kind of video news channel that I know that I watch. And I was like, there's quite a lot of power that you now have. Do you feel that at all? Do you feel like a responsibility, like at all?
Responsibility, 100%. I think we are influential in the architecture and construction sectors to a point. I think let's not run away with ourselves. Like it's not that big, but we've seen it from the way architects and developers and clients care about the video creation process, the way they get a lot more involved and sit up straight once we're around the table, which is great, especially from where it started. You know, no one wanted to talk to me or email me back. So that's quite a nice place to be now. It's definitely a lot easier than things were.
Well, you can answer Bill's original question before we went on air that I refused to let you answer, which was at what point did that shift happen where people suddenly were trusting you and coming to you and instead of you having to go around and kind of corral people to come on and they didn't know who you were? Like,
it's a good question. And when you've lived it, there wasn't really an overnight thing. It's been a progressive, slow change. And I'm still the same professional, caring person that I was before anyone cared about me, which is quite frustrating. And that's quite a good way to keep yourself grounded. You know, I'm pleased I met and married my wife before I started the B1M because we knew each other before this happened, which is quite a good thing. I think, you know, 2018 was definitely a tipping point. I think once the audience started to go over 100,000 subscribers and then 1 million subscribers, suddenly it was easier to talk to people and get video content produced, and that made it then easier to do it again and get the next interview and get more access from there. So yeah, I think up until 2018 we were, I use the phrase, chipping away and calling in favors and trying to get this thing in front of people. And that's where I was really tested and really developed, and that's where I think a lot of the pressure came from. I mean, I'm under pressure as it is now, but it's a different kind of pressure. It's less existential. It's more, you know, about, to your point, influence, impact, responsibility, the consequences of decisions we're taking on building developments, our team, recruitment, people's lives. You know, it's a big, yeah.
I wonder if one of the biggest impacts is about attracting talent into construction as an industry. So it does have a problem. It's perceived as something that you don't want to do later in your life because you don't feel like going up on a crane when you're 15 years old in the howling winds of February. I know, you know, I worked in China for a long time and a lot of families just had one child and they didn't want their prince or princess going into construction or hotel or hospitality. They wanted them to go into medicine. And I just think shining a light on the impact it makes on humanity, the scale of the change and the need for capable people. I wonder, you know, I want to tease you out a bit more about, you said plans beyond YouTube. I can't let that just hang without saying something. I wonder if it is, you know, it could well be something about bringing young people into the profession instead of thinking that, well, you're the sort of bad example, but instead of everyone going to tech because of the quick wins, you know, and actually, is there a strength to slowness like governance?
Yeah, I think going back to the impact thing, I think I need to let other people judge the impact I've had and whether or not it was a successful or not, or whether it was a worthwhile idea. I think me answering that inevitably comes with a high degree of bias. I think, obviously, I'm not going to discuss full strategy on a podcast. Sorry, guys. Yeah. I just think we've worked really hard at creating really good explainer-style video content on YouTube that's up there with the likes of the stuff that the mainstream publishers can produce. You know, we've deliberately hired people from mainstream publishers. We've hired people from broadcast backgrounds and brought them into our team and tried to match some other big brands out there. But, you know, the recipe of cover a subject area, put some interesting content about it online, build an audience, drive revenue through that audience, be an influencer, is fun, but it's what everyone else is doing and it's not really going to change the world. I want to go far beyond that. I want to use the platform we've got now to really push beyond that, to connect with people and captivate them, not just entertain them or educate them, but captivate them in a way that they haven't been captivated before through this publishing medium or other publishing mediums on this subject area that we know now is so engaging, so impactful to the world, and that they didn't really know they appreciated until our stuff came along.
Did you, correct me if I'm wrong, when you originally started, it was like the name B1M was about as a play on BIM, right? And then, because that was really new, and then that's kind of just become a term that everyone uses. But weren't you doing like educational courses and things that people could go to? Like, so you've kind of gone full circle, you've taken it back, but now the idea that you could maybe teach in a much more creative and fun way about construction as opposed to focusing on BIM.
Yeah, I don't think we'll go back down the kind of online courses route. I think, if I say online courses, we were putting together our educational YouTube videos into a structured playlist that you could watch and be educated. And yeah, I wouldn't say it's online training.
No.
But yeah, I think the concept of people having to either be entertained or learn don't need to be two different things. They can be the same thing. And actually, if you entertain people and you captivate them and you engage them to a point where they are telling their family and friends about it, and actually they don't want to watch Netflix or anything on TV, they want to go on YouTube and watch our stuff, or they've heard about it or it's been shared to them, is where I want to get to with it. And yes, it's educational, yes, it's informative, but at its core, there's a bloody good story, and it's put together and structured and told in such a way that it is unbelievable.
I heard Netflix. Did you hear Netflix?
Yeah,
I heard Netflix.
You've got aspirations.
Yeah.
Well, I mean,
they're only like 200 million subs ahead of me.
You'll get there. Well, we're coming up to the kind of the 40-minute mark. Did you have a question? You looked like you're going to say something. You were in a power station. Your last two videos, power station in France. You're in the Elizabeth line, which supposedly is going to open soon. So I'm told. What's coming up? What amazing videos. How do you top a nuclear power? No, not even a nuclear power station. A special fusion power generator that doesn't even exist for the next 20 years. What have you got next? The moon?
Yeah. It's pretty impossible, really. We've got some really good stuff on the horizon. Obviously, I would say that. I'm being overly positive.
Click subscribe. Yeah. Punch that subscribe button.
I think just going places that people wouldn't normally be able to get into, or revealing things they didn't know about in an interesting way, is the recipe. I think, yeah, it's impossible to top going inside a nuclear fusion reactor or, yeah, the stuff we've done in New York and stuff. But I think it's about just taking the core of that recipe and applying it to different things. So we've got a really good thing coming up in the Faroe Islands. They've built this ridiculous undersea roundabout, which we're doing a documentary on over there, which should be really exciting. We're doing another long form feature on HS2, which is exciting as well. We've got a very exciting plan for our big Christmas documentary, which is already underway in April, which is ridiculous, I know. But yeah, like, there's some good things coming. I think we're not trying to necessarily top ourselves. It's more about what can we learn from that entertainment experience people have had? How can we apply that to another situation, and will it work?
And then, so the final thing, what architectural trends for us as architects do you think are, like, because you have such a holistic view of the whole industry. What are the big topics?
Say, yeah. As I sit here going, shit, what trends can I come up with?
Go on, quickly.
Obviously, I think the changing face of our cities. So the idea of, I think I said this to you last time, but everyone commuting into the middle of a city to go to an office is kind of over, or it's being massively questioned now. So the future of work, where do we work? What does that look like? What do our homes look like now? Many of us are working from home. What does that mean for rural infrastructure, those kind of things? I think housing is a really big one. You know, most developed countries around the world are facing some form of housing crisis, and that's being met in part by large high-rise developments that are targeted at billionaires in city centres that don't really address it in any way, that ostensibly are trying to solve the housing crisis. So there's a big question mark there. I think the adoption of tech as well is going to be a huge thing. Probably no surprise there, but I think the, not necessarily innovation in the construction industry, but the general technology advancement in the world around us is helping modernize these sectors. So in all kinds of ways, of whether that's digital collaboration, cloud computing, online working, remote working, those kind of things. So yeah, I think there's material innovations coming as well. So I think the climate change thing is hugely throwing into sharp relief the use of steel, concrete, and all those kind of materials. So I think alternatives to that's going to really come to the fore. It's been talked about for a long time. I think in the next few years, people are going to be really forced to look at alternative materials like cross-laminated timber, those kind of things.
Yeah, that tower you've got on there, built out of timber, looks absolutely amazing. Right, I'm going to end it there. Thank you so much, Fred. Until next year, my birthday.
Yeah. Yeah. Any jokes you want to throw out now from
no,
5 years ago?
No, I didn't listen to that one. Thank you, Fred.
Thank you. Great.